they say we should have known better than to fall so deep down into this rabbit hole.
Get we found. Ready. It's time again to venture down the rabbit hole into the world of cybersecurity. You're plugged into the podcast for security leaders and practitioners with a business sense. Prepare for unique interviews, insights, and practical advice that makes your job just a bit easier. And now, please welcome your guides on this adventure, James Jardine and the White Rabbit, Ruffalos.
James is messing with his audio. All right, good morning, good afternoon, and good evening. Welcome down to Security Rabbit Hole to another edition of the Down the Security Rabbit Hole podcast. This is Raf, and good morning to you. Good early Friday morning to you. We're recording and streaming live, a little advanced episode for you. I thought that we'd have a great topic on par today. This is one of my favorite pet topics, and who else better to talk about it than my friend Jim, who might have a little bit to say on this subject as well. The Mr. Globetrotter himself over there lately. How are you, Jim?
Doing good. Can you hear me okay?
Yeah, I can hear you fine.
Slight thing. Yeah, I'm doing great, man. Thanks a lot for inviting me. I'm looking forward to having this conversation.
We're gonna get James back any minute now because he's gonna figure out his audio. There you are.
Yeah, I don't know. Sorry if I'm here now. I don't know what the heck happened. Like, for some reason, I just lost all audio.
Want to be participating this morning?
Oh. I get it. All right. It's funny. It all works. You record.
Right. It's a Friday morning. Half the world's on vacation right now. So I don't blame people for having technical issues. But all right, guys, subject this morning. In the security industry, this is a often ignored at your own peril topic, and that is the one of services, okay? And I mean, like, hey, you buy something, you get the services with it. Everything from pen testing all the way down to architectural design services, all kinds of servicey services. Now, having been in this space for quite some time as well, I've as you guys can probably guess, I'm kind of a fan. Current job is leading a services organization on the go-to-market. And so I am a firm believer that services in some capacity and form is essential to enterprise security. Jim, you've run services organizations since since I got into this industry. So not to overstate your wisdom,
gray wisdom, as it were.
Right. But you're a firm believer in the services area, right?
Yeah. I mean, I grew up, I mean, I started in security in the early 90s and then immediately go, wow, you know, I can learn more, do more, share more, arguably accomplish more, do cooler stuff if I kind of did this as a consultant. And then I went in that particular direction. And you know, it exposes you to different environments, which is really important, I think, in any profession, really, right? But especially in cybersecurity. And then from there, you know, it just kept leading to going from small engagements to big engagements, small teams to big teams, teams to groups to, you know, companies, that kind of thing. So I've been in services for a very long time, and I've had the interesting opportunity to kind of flip back and forth a little bit as a consultant working for organizations in a leadership role. And then now, you know, I'm, you know, now formerly a CISO for a global company. So I have a really unique perspective as a consumer, as well as a provider for, you know, several decades.
Yeah. James, you've been in the services space for quite a bit. You have your own, company for a bit there, or still have?
Yeah. You know, it's interesting, Jim, what you hit on there, the ability to be able to see all kinds of different things, you know, versus being in one organization, seeing that your entire life. You know, I look back to even my dev days, you know, when I was a programmer, you know, it doesn't take long these days. Technology moves so fast. Like, if you've been sitting at a spot for 4 years in the same company, you know, it's hard to even move out of that because what you've been working on, we can't change as an organization that fast. So, I mean, I still know people that are working in major organizations that still work on like web forms with .NET, which is like so archaic now. I mean, yeah, they still upkeep it, but you know, it's so difficult for them even to try to get out. Like they're locked in. It's like the old COBOL days where you're kind of locked in. So, you know, you can't understate the value of being able to get out and see what other organizations are doing, from large organizations to small organizations. And I think that's a key point, that when we talk about services, that's a huge thing that those bring. It's not that it's, oh, it's external experts or this or that. Like, we have maybe internal people that do this, but they have like such a vast experience that we don't necessarily get to see on a day-to-day basis.
I'll give you guys a good counterpoint that I don't know about good. I'll give you guys a counterpoint that I've heard many times to the consultant way or the services way. And that is, well, you don't actually have to be responsible for how this thing goes. You're just here to tell me about how it should be, point out some things, and off you go to your next thing. And I was like, well, okay, I guess that's fair, but that's just the really crappy ones.
Right? So one is that value proposition that James highlighted plays in both directions, plays for the individual as well as the company, right? Now, your point about you don't have to live with your decision, I'm going to kind of throw you a curveball. I think in today's world, with not getting down that too far down this path at the moment, but you have hyper specialization in security and you have people changing jobs pretty regularly. I mean, I vividly remember years ago, and I've seen it constantly since, where people were judging candidates for a job saying, well, you haven't changed jobs enough, right? You've been in the same place for, you know, 3-4 years, you know. And then here's a resume where somebody's changed jobs every 12 months. And like, this guy looks great, or whoever, got gal kind of thing. Yeah. And for me, that's just like, it blows my mind. So this whole concept of living with the decisions, I don't think is limited to consultants, not by a long shot.
Yeah. You know, that's very interesting. I've seen the opposite of it. Like I've been, you know, 6.5 years in one place, 5 years in another. And my longevity seems to be then kind of waning, right? 3.5, 2, 2. But it's interesting because I guess there's just different types of people out there, and there really are. There's those that like to build something from scratch. There's those that like to maintain that thing, and those that like to come in at some point where it's sort of broken down and it's starting to lose its effectiveness and fix it. Right. I'm of that third category, and there is absolutely nothing wrong. And you're right. You know, judging resumes that way used to be a thing. I remember, Jim, we were interviewing, you know, we were looking at people like, oh man, this person's been, you know, this person changes jobs. I remember seeing it the other way, like, oh man, you change jobs every year. Like, what's wrong with you? Like, can you not be successful any place? Because, you know, when you look at, I heard a recruiter once tell me, they look at, this is probably 3-4 years ago, that, you know, typically accountability takes about somewhere between 18 months and 24 months to really kind of come around. Right. All the policies as a CISO, as all policies you put in, the changes you make, they start to really show bear fruit in about 18 to 24 months. And he goes, I can always tell which CISOs are good and which ones just sort of, you know, drop the grenade, throw it in, look around a little bit and bail. Because they're usually about 18 months to 24 months. And about that time that it's like, OK, well, tell us about what you did. They're like, yeah, see ya. I'm off. Right. And so that becomes that, but that translates over. You know, the dark side of this is, though, man, as a consultant, you know, it is really easy to get lost in the just do this. Like, I've seen it before. Just do this. It'll be fine. It'll work. And it's the part that you miss in that advisory capacity. It is all the layers above the traditional OSI model, right? It layers 8, 9, and 10, management, budget, and bullshit, right? Because you don't know what the internal politics are, right? I remember years ago, long time ago, we were having difficulty. This is kind of up our alley. We were having difficulty with AppSec with some really badly old apps. GE Energy, I think. No, GE Consumer Finance. Anyway, one of the GEs. And the solution was, well, you know what? Maybe the short-term solution is just put a WAF in front of all of them temporarily to block all the bad things that we know about, and until we can get them fixed, right? They're like, 12 to 24 months is how long it's going to take to get these things fixed. So it's like, all right, went out and did a POC for a WAF that, you know, the first generations that were still, I still have like a Net Continuum shirt. I still wow. have an old school Imperva shirt. And I forget the third one, the one that ended up being sold to Citrix. I forget what the name of it was. Jim, do you remember, James? Because Citrix bought one of them, and I forget the name of it. Maybe it was that continuum. Anyway. And so we were like, all right, I've selected one. We're ready to go. We're like, you know, 2 months. It took me 2 months to do that. I figure, wow, that's way faster than 12 to 24 months. And then I spent 18 months trying to put them in.
That's it.
Because I had what nobody told me was, you know, I had a point of fact that all of those applications ran off of two head end app servers. Then the back end was all different. But if I was going to schedule an outage to put something in front of that cluster, I'd have to schedule with every one of the 30 some odd apps. Some of them didn't even need the rebuilds, right? So none of they were like, well, I don't need you to do this. I'm like, but everybody else does. Please, dear God, let me do. So it took me longer almost than. But the consultants were like, oh, just put it in. You know, we got the architecture. Just put it in. Go. I was like, that's not how this works.
I think, Raf, though, what you highlight that and with the point you made just a minute ago as well, the difference between good consultants that are coming in to actually learn your systems, learn your environment versus consultants that just come in. Like I used to hate, this is one of the reasons why I left a previous consulting thing, is I hated the fact that we would come in, we'd test for a week, we'd throw a report over the fence and say, good luck, have a good day. Mm-hmm. Right? We didn't know nothing about their systems besides what we tested. It was, here's a report, go fix it. Right. And that's the type of stuff that people are like, oh, well, you don't have to implement this. And it's like, you're right. I'm just here to test it. Out you go. Right. Versus services that are coming in. And I think we're seeing more of this, but they're actually spending that time to understand your environment, understand what you're doing and say, look, we're not just going to tell you go output and code. We're going to actually understand what you're doing and say, here's how you can go about doing this and put forth the effort to say, this isn't an overnight change. You know, I think a lot of people expect, oh, I got this gap analysis. I need to do this overnight. Like, build a road plan for this. Like, how are we going to do this? But I think there's a difference between people that come in and actually advise and understand your environment versus companies that just say, oh, yeah, we'll do that analysis. They don't ever talk to anybody. They look at some architecture diagrams that you sent them and they're like, here's what you need. Boom, see you later. Like, those aren't going to go well.
So that Jim, that takes me to the dichotomy that you created, strategic and tactical services. Remember that?
Talk to me about that a
little bit.
We used to do like tactical, remedial, and strategic kind of thing. So you guys just talked about a lot of stuff I want to touch on. So first,
go
the change. Yeah, exactly. The changing jobs. It reminds me of the three letters, right? A guy leaves, writes three letters. A new guy comes in. You know the drill, right? First letter, yes. Blame the team. Blame me. Blame team. Then write three letters.
Yeah.
Also, I want to comment on that, and I do mean this sincerely, and I think it'll set the tone for the conversation. But I hated coming in and having a tactical kind of conversation. I'm all about the journey. I'm all about painting the bridge. And you know, I get it. There are times when you know you need to come in and take a look at something and provide a report. But even when I consulted years ago or part of our projects or whatever the case be, even today with my executive leadership team, I always sort of frame everything saying, listen, I can help you, but it's going to be, you know, it's going to be an investment of time as we look at more broader elements so I can better understand the environment, understand everything from your interpretation of risk and appetite to what is your true vision on technology and threats and be able to start there. And so you have a meaningful application of strategy. And back to what James saying is creating a roadmap. I'm also going to add another point is I believe one of the biggest challenges today is execution. Everybody talks a game constantly. Everybody's talking, nobody's doing. Consultancies have had a heyday in just coming in and doing assessments. And then it's kind of a double-edged sword is because, James, to your point, I don't disagree whatsoever coming in and learning the environment. But I would argue that customers have been organizations that are consuming services have been somewhat burned, I guess, in some way, shape, or form, or have limited budgets. They don't have time to sort of train you up on their world. They want, you know, they want those bumps and bruises, the lessons learned that you bring to the environment. And you want, I think good consultants want to take customers on a journey and be with them, right? I like the idea of coming in, understanding, and then quickly moving to roadmapped execution and being part of that so you can adjust your trajectory, because you may have been wrong during the assessment. You may have drawn certain conclusions that manifested differently. Like Raph was saying, you know, I didn't know, you know, I had to go to like 40 different departments to get them to check a box before we could implement anything, right? And, you know, mm-hmm. those things are hard to detect when you get into layers 8, 9, and 10 kind of thing. So I think it's a really interesting challenge. And we've also created an environment and services where things are transactional, whether we've driven that as an industry or whether we're reacting to that as customers wanting to be, I just need to get this pen test, let's go, you know, the kind of thing. It's a very interesting scenario. But okay, to your question, tactical versus strategic, is I believe that if you can help an organization, and by applying services, and I mean by the specific skill sets and capabilities and lessons learned to attack a particular element, but if you go into it thinking that you're going to solve bigger problems, you're going to fail miserably, and the customer's not going to be happy, and they're not going to get what they wanted, and they're going to want their money back in a minimum way. So I've always been about, how do we make sure that if we're going to do something tactical, and I'm not saying pen tests are tactical, but that's pretty much the most, you know, biggest one in the scenario, but is how do we drive that value proposition so it has a role within a larger strategic direction? You know, I think fundamentally that's it, but yeah, we can kind of get into that pretty deeply. It's all about that. Unfortunately, it's controlled by the selling process, you know, how do you develop the relationship, and the people that you're bringing to bear for a client have a big influence on how well successful it is. And we've said it 3-4 times now. It's all about, sometimes it comes down to the individual consultant and how best they execute against the vision you establish with the client.
I got to tell you, I've worked for organizations, including yours, where the effectiveness, or at least the perception of effectiveness at the customer of the organization, was down to not necessarily the individual consultant, because any individual person could do poorly or well.
Yes.
But at the way that projects were scoped, and this is, I think, the thing that really stuck into my head working for you, was the way we figured out, okay, this is what I'm hearing you tell me you want the problem that as you define it. Say that back to me. Great. We agree. This is how I'm going to apply my expertise to solve this problem. We're not going over here. We're not going over there. We're not going to try to, you know, solve the world hunger problem. Like, this is the thing you want me to solve. This is the outcome we're going to have. And this is what it's going to look like when we're done. And it's, I think that is when you look at where I've seen consulting projects over my career catastrophically blow up and fail, and get to the point where you're on the phone with the customer and you're like, okay, so we're sorry, you know, this has gone badly. All right, well, how can we make this better? Like, you get there because somebody at the beginning didn't scope properly and didn't define the outcome properly.
I'm kind of, Raph knows me all too well, man. I'm literally squirming in my chair because this topic upsets me. So hang on tight. So first of all, people desperately underestimate the importance of a statement of work. And I don't care what you say, I can find a hole in your interpretation. You can see I'm getting kind of heated up, right? Everything stems from that. And what I can't stand is what I call selling through sow, right? So a customer gets a document, right? And it's like, hey, look how great we are, blah, 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 blah. And we're going to do these things. And it doesn't put it into context, right? Context is everything, because it tells you what you're going to do, how you're going to articulate it, where you understand the risk assumptions, where you're looking at, how you're going to focus. What is your methodology? You don't need to say, and we're going to use our proven methodology, which is helpful, but what is how you're going to apply that methodology to this specific need? And not only that, but you said it really importantly. The first thing I've ever done is I go, okay, here's our interpretation of what you told us, and here's how we're laying that out into an overall engagement strategy. And that strategy is established of these sets of activities, and here's where we're going to put the boundaries on that. And people just completely underestimate the art form that it requires to do that correctly. So the reason why I get so excited about this is because so many projects fail, just absolutely miserable. I've sat in more, unfortunately, meetings, literally sitting with lawyers word by word. Well, you said this in the statement of work, or when people write statements of work and they put their name in it as like, you know, Bob's going to deliver. I'm like, no, don't do that. then we get into the interpretation of the level of effort. And so if you don't quantify it correctly in your activities and what your intended outcomes are and deliverables are and kind of how you're going to execute, you can't understand that level of effort. And I think over the last, I mean, for me, this really started, a long time ago. But when we saw sort of this automation of statements of work, it started off with like automated responses to RFPs and RFIs. And these are good, but they're not designed to answer. They're designed to answer questions, you know, answer this question. Yeah. And here's a template, which is fine. But when you're having a strategic conversation with a higher ranking executive or your point of contact or the decision maker in an organization, and they're expressing something like, well, we're looking for an audit and we want it to do this. Now, I know when they say audit, they mean assessment. And I know when they say technical audit, they really mean security operational aspects of policy and standards, right? So you have to sort of envision the ultimate objective and interpret that. What is the intent they're seeking, and connect with them, and then find some way to relate that in a document. And when that's done well and you put the energy up front, it pays huge dividends in the background, because there's very little rescoping. There's very little ambiguity. You know, every status report, every milestone objective is being hit because everybody understands exactly what those expectations are. And you manage according to those expectations.
Well, I always used to ask, how do we know when we're done? How do we know it's as silly. So two roles ago, there would be services, SOWs that would just be like, yeah, we're going to do this, this, this. And I came in and read this. I was like, I looked at the team. I was like, how do we know when we're done? Like, what do you mean? So how do we know when this engagement is complete? Like when the customer is happy, I'm like, no, no, never, ever ending. Right. Cause I can keep giving you more work. Like that's not hard. But how do you know? And the whole outcomes discussion on when, you know, it drives to the conversation of where I want to go with this a little bit next is fixed bid versus hourly. Because
and you're good.
I'm going to put.
I forgot you worked. We worked together. We worked together a long time, so you know all.
I'm going to push all the buttons, Jim. but for me, that is a it's a pet peeve when somebody of mine, when somebody says, well, this is going to be X. Per, like in the bottom of the statement of work is it's going to be X amount of dollars per hour times this many hours. And I'm like, okay, but that may sound good to you, because I know customers will ask, well, how much is this costing me, you know, an hour, or how much? You're like, okay, but you're paying for, by the way, in case you can't tell, I'm a big fixed bid guy. Like I love.
Oh yeah. We're going to get into it.
Yeah. I like fixed amount of dollars for two reasons. One, it doesn't penalize me for being efficient and better and getting better at delivery, right? From a provider side.
We'll come back to that in this conversation about a statement of work here shortly.
Yeah. Fair enough. I'm not focused on how many hours I have to bill. I'm focusing on, you want this outcome, and I'm going to tell you the value of achieving that outcome is X. If you're like, that's worth it to me to get that outcome, great, I'll drive to there.
And as long a client?
As a provider, I'm asking you, what's the outcome you want? You say, I would like this architect, my new cloud architecture defined. I go, great, that's going to cost you $25K based on the level of expertise we bring, the amount of work we believe it takes. And you're like, yeah, it's worth 25 grand, right? And you're like, okay. It's kind of like how I look at vacation. Somebody's like, man, that vacation's 15K. That's expensive. I'm like, yeah, but I get to see like 12 time zones. I get to be out on the ocean. I get to see the mountains. Like, yeah, it's worth it to me, right? Like to me, that's worth it. I'm not going to say, okay, well, but how much is the boat ride versus, I don't know, how much am I paying per meal? It's a little Raph pricey. Like, you know what, the whole thing, that's worth it to me. So, I, you know, there's something to that. I like being able to tell a customer, you told me this is the thing you want. I'm telling you this is the thing I'm going to deliver. If you think this, the value in this is X, great. And I have... It behooves me to find good experts, deliver that excellence in as fast as time as possible, because that's how I make my wider margins, right? You have to be able to assume, you have to be able to plan correctly and scope correctly. Now, the ownership from the vendor there is then like, you got to be able to know your staff and know what's possible to deliver and how much time. Otherwise, you're going to lose money on every single one. But over time, I think mature organizations get there. I'm going to leave it there and let you go, Jim, because I know you've
got something. All right, here we go. First of all, let's say what really is fixed versus T&E or T&M, however you want to say it, right? Fundamentally, it's a risk management. It's two things, risk management, business risk management, and customer management, right? Customers like it for all the reasons you mentioned, right? I get an outcome. That outcome overall is worth this much to me, and it locks you in as a provider. Mm-hmm. So I can say, you know, hey, I'm not satisfied. Right. So from a provider perspective, and you really hit on it, is you really got to know, you have to have done it before and understand what specifically are the conditions within the environment you're going to assist that have an effect on your level of effort. Right. So sometimes things are really cookie cutter, and sometimes there are certain characteristics. I'm going to go back to pen testing, right? You're pen testing the application. I'm going to want to know how many active pages there are as opposed to static. And that's going to affect sort of inherently the level of effort. And then I can put that in my little calculator and we're off to the races. But ultimately, it is from a provider perspective, it's all about managing risk. And what I mean by that is you're making a bet that you're going to improve your margins by doing it faster and better. Right. And that's what,
yes,
that is ultimately it. And you're assuming in this case is that it's easier to sell because it's more compartmentalized and more packaged, and the customer can relate to that price to the outcome. Okay. No doubt on that. Okay. The key aspects here is you have to know exactly what you're doing, and you have to make sure the client is very clear on what those outputs are. So sample deliverables are going to be a really big deal. Sample specific expectations, and also setting particular boundaries. You said it earlier about knowing when you're done, and that's very difficult in fixed price models, especially at the larger the project gets. I mean, when you're doing I've done fixed price gigs, you know, north of $3-4 million, and that gets pretty terrifying. And you have a lot of people working that may not be interested in how many hours, they're focused on the outcome. But as a business, you're very much focused on that particular effort.
Sure.
Even though those costs may be sunk. So I think, and of course, all that is implied within the statement of work. The thing here is there's also one more component, and it has to do with more of mundane things like revenue recognition and how you build the statement of work around particular milestones. Otherwise, you're not going to see any money until it's done. And then, you know, you have to kind of sign off. You may see invoices, but you're not going to see a rev rec. So it changes the complexion on that. And I'll add to this is having worked for and run my fair share of fairly large services organizations, I've been exposed to a lot of different good, the bad, the ugly on these things. And when you do an analysis, you find the what I call over under. So how many, you take a total number of revenue and fixed, total number of revenue and T&E, and you map it against profitability or over under scope against a particular established target for each. Where was your over? Where was your under? Where did you make more money than you expected? And where did you lose money when you sort of merge these two together? And I'm going to tell you, in most cases, in very, very good companies, it's almost a net zero. Each one has, your losses were accommodated appropriately through the evolution when you're comparing to the two the contract models, or are you just looking at fixed price, seeing where did I lose and where did I win? You sometimes get to a net zero. But I can tell you in a lot of cases, the demand for customers to drive fixed price pull service companies into making mistakes, in that it is a very custom deal. And we're not really prepared to fully understand the risk. So you agree to a custom and then you find yourself being dragged into it. So a lot of fixed price deals actually find organizations in an over under profit or less profitable. They find themselves on average less profitable because the core is know what you're doing. Like, for example, if you were to pull a car in my driveway and say, hey, I need you to change the oil, I can say, yeah, sure, I can do it for, you know, $15 because I know how long it's going to take me and you pay for the oil, to make a simple thing. And the type of car really doesn't matter too much unless it's, you know, staying away from Ferraris and Lamborghinis or whatever. But the but if you pull in a semi truck or you say, I have a vehicle, and I'm like, well, wait a second, is it a jet airplane or, you know, what is it? And you're kind of like, okay, well, I'll apply my fixed cost strategy to that. That's the biggest point. So it can be enormously helpful on both sides. It requires a degree of sophistication that some people are failing to apply.
I was going to say, like, agreeing with Raf's point on that and yours as well, a lot of that has to do with, if you're doing fixed price, you have to really understand what you're doing. You know, so as Raf said, like, the more mature your organization gets,
right,
the better chances you can pull off fixed price, until they come up with something that is like, okay, this doesn't fit our fixed price model. We need to switch this back out because we haven't done this before, or, you know, having to be able to juggle between those two.
And they, and a lot of salespeople don't do that. A lot of business leadership fear that, well, we've been doing fixed price with everything. We just do it. And, you know, and of course they're looking for the commission, right?
Jim, did it make sense then to have a series or a segment of core services that you have high degrees of confidence and maturity in that you offer as a fixed price? And then sort of these, when you sort of look at and go, okay, this one, like, this is a out of the boundary of things that we're really, really good at doing repetitively over and over again, that's going to be a T&M kind of thing. Do you stratify
absolutely.
Like exits?
Absolutely. Yeah. I would say I would say my first warning in that space is, don't just take small things and make them fixed price, right? You want to take things that are not only core to what you do, exploit your intellectual property, your capabilities, your methodologies, your intellectual property as it relates to your TTPs and methodologies, right? So it can be big and gnarly and complex. And then you take a solution to market and everybody else's T&E are charging a lot of money, and you've managed to build efficiencies that allow you to do that in a very confident manner. So I would see it more as ways of applying your strengths and also repeating them, and then giving it an opportunity for organizations to say, well, how can I customize this, and say, okay, well, we can take a mixture of these capabilities and apply them to your environment, and then maybe look at it in a mixed mode sort of scenario or a phased project, or then just say, look, we're just going to go full on custom and leverage those same strengths. But yeah, I would look at a portfolio and look at, you know, what are my core strengths as an organization and how those resonate most deeply with companies.
I want to end, because good Lord, time goes quick.
Yeah,
I want to end on this now. No, this is all really good info. I want to end on this though. In the field where you've got different capabilities in different companies, developing those core services, those ancillary services, and trying to figure out what it is that you're going to do. How do you determine, and this is probably, you've touched on it, but I want to really put a fine point on this. One of the biggest mistakes, the biggest, that I've seen organizations that really, really screw it up do, is they either do everything by SAO or everything is a SKU, right? So it's either pre-built and you just sign this and we go, or everything is fully custom and everything takes, you know, 6 weeks to scope and everything takes, like, talk to me about striking the balance between a statement of work and a pre-built SKU.
I always focus on leveraging the strengths of the team to help identify trends and opportunities with organizations. And let's just say I have one service, but I start seeing us do other things. All of us T&E, all of us statement of work, I find sort of expertise that knows how to, the art form of defining a statement of work. And then as it becomes more predictable, then you take a step back from a portfolio perspective and understand, what is the extent of my capabilities? What is the cost to improve my capabilities or hire to the, if that services were to grow? What are the sort of competitive and market scenarios? So is this long? Is this something I should invest in? And then once you start tilting toward something more significant as a product, then you begin to integrate it in a more standardized process with setting a threshold. Don't start getting into fully automated statements of work and stuff like that unless the customer and the volume demand that type of automation. one of the things I will tell you is when it comes to statements of work, portfolio management, and service development, is there's this overwhelming sense to automate everything without having proved it out first, you know? And so I think in this particular case, you find out what you're doing well, what you have the capabilities, the methods, the tools to facilitate, and then you start standardizing around that. But don't standardize something that nobody's going to buy as a standard. You know, you can still leverage those capabilities as part of other projects or pieces of it. You can build, you know, I call it, you know, baking the cake. You know, I'm not going to make just a giant lump of sugar, because nobody's going to buy that, but they'll buy a cake where it requires some sugar, right? So I think you have to be sort of thoughtful in that process. Standardize what sells as a standard and what you can deliver as a standard. Everything else should be looking to go in that direction, but you need to focus on flexibility in the beginning.
I love it. That's some sage wisdom right there. We could keep talking about this too, but maybe we'll do another revision of this as we go, Jim. But sure. Thanks for appreciate your time as always and your expertise. And good luck on a new gig, man. You are getting around the world now. I love seeing the pictures.
Yeah, it's awesome. It's a great company. I'm real happy, and things are going well. And I really appreciate you having me on, man. It's been fun. It's been real, real fun.
James, thanks, Jim. I think this has been a good refresher, James, because I this is a topic that you live in quite a bit. I live in quite a bit, and I feel like it doesn't get discussed enough. And I think this is where a lot of really good companies can make or break their relationships with customers. And we'll talk about we'll do this again, Jim, and we'll talk about relationship management that way because we both have some experience.
Yeah, I think too, Rob, you know, I mean, this is one of those things. It doesn't get a lot of coverage, but it's also it's like that don't talk about it. But a lot of people don't understand how to work with service vendors and providers and, you know, understanding these different points between the fixed versus T&E versus all these different things to really understand what am I getting myself into? Because, you know, we just talked about Jim just went over, you know, talking about the importance of creating a good sow and all this stuff from the vendor side almost, but not as much on the client side as a, hey, look, it's just as important for you to understand that everything is laid out how you want it. Nobody wants to get to the end of that job and be the one sitting there with lawyers going line by line saying, okay, you didn't do this or you didn't do it, right? Like nobody wants to get there. So, I mean, it's just as important to focus on it, even from that side, for people to understand how to engage from that.
Yeah, we'll do that. Hey, by the way, if you're listening and you're like, yeah, I've got some experience with this on the buyer side, get a hold of us. We'll have you on the show. We'll bring Jim back and we'll have a really good discussion on on both sides of the table. But for now, it's goodbye. Thanks for joining us, folks. This has been another edition of the Down the Security Rabbit Hole podcast. We hope you're enjoying the summer. And we hope you're enjoying the series as we go, as we try to get to 600 and who knows what's beyond there. So we'll see you guys at another time, another place on another Down the Security Rabbit Hole podcast. Thanks. Bye-bye.
As we fade out on another Down the Security Rabbit Hole episode, we'd like to encourage you to chat with our hosts and guests using the Twitter hashtag #DTSR. Please check out the show notes, catch up on any episodes you may have missed, and subscribe so you don't miss a future episode. So on behalf of Rafal, James, for now it's goodbye. We'll see you soon on another Down the Security Rabbit Hole podcast.